So you could really title a message series on Romans any number of ways. And last year, as I was looking through the book of Romans, and as I was considering what our series might look like in regards to Romans, I considered a number of different options. There are so many different matters of importance, so many different themes that emerge, so many different things that come up throughout the book of Romans that it's hard to choose just one thing when you're coming to name the series. And so for a while, with all of those choices, the most clever name that I was coming up with was something like Paul's Letter to the Romans. And so I had that working title for a while I was filling out different weeks. And then as I was reading more in the book of Romans, and as I was reading commentaries or other people that had written about Paul's letter to the church in Rome, and even as I was considering my own favorite Bible passage in Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, I just kept coming back to this idea of the transformed life, to this idea of transformation in the book of Romans, and really how in Romans chapters 1 to 11, Paul's writing about how our lives are transformed through Christ. You know, over and over again, he's explaining the gospel and different facets of the gospel and what Jesus has done on our behalf. And then he begins to work into this section where he talks about what it looks like to live out that transformation, what it looks like to actually live in a way that reflects the transformation we've experienced in Christ. And as he begins that, what we've seen so far in chapters 12 and 13 is that this life of transformation looks a lot like a life of loving and caring for others. And then we get into this section in chapter 14 where Paul begins to address some problems that exist in and among the Roman Christians, really in this idea of loving one another. So let's begin reading in Romans chapter 14, verse 1. And in there we see, "As for the one who has a different opinion, welcome him, but not to quarrel over opinions. One person believes he may wear a mask while the other person refuses. Let not the one who wears a mask despise the one who abstains, and let not the one who abstains from wearing a mask pass judgment on the one who does, for God has welcomed him. Who are you to pass judgment on the servant of another? It is before his own master that he stands or falls, and he will be upheld, for the Lord is able to make him stand." And this reading comes from the New Pandemic Version in the 2020 edition. And really, all kidding aside, and all mention of masks aside, these are what Paul's actual words are in Romans chapter 14, beginning in verse 1. It says, "As for the one who is weak in faith, welcome him, but not to quarrel over opinions. One person believes that he may eat anything, while the weak person eats only vegetables. Let not the one who eats despise the one who abstains, and let not the one who abstains pass judgment on the one who eats, for God has welcomed him. Who are you to pass judgment on the servant of another? It is before his own master that he stands or falls, and he will be upheld, for the Lord is able to make him stand." There was a problem in the Roman church. Christians, as Paul's writing about here, were passing judgment over one another, putting judgment on one another over matters of opinion, over matters of secondary importance. They were taking things that were not the main thing, that were not the most important thing, that weren't, you know, matters of core doctrine, truth, or weren't matters of who Jesus was and what he had done, and they were taking things that were secondary, and they were elevating them to that level of core importance. And then, when someone didn't agree with them on these secondary matters, they were judging them for that. And that term judging is often the negative connotation of judging when we think of it. It's not just that they were making an evaluation, they weren't, you know, providing an assessment of other people's opinions, they were condemning them for the opinions that they held in regards to these secondary matters. So essentially, to use that popular phrase that talks about the importance in life of majoring in the majors and minoring in the minors, what was taking place in the Roman church is that there were people there that were majoring in the minors, and not only majoring in them, but then also insisting that other people agree with them or that they were standing condemned. In some translations, like the NIV, at the end of verse 1, uses the phrase disputable matters, where the ESV uses the phrase opinions there. And it's this idea that there are items in the faith that two people who are serious about their faith, that two people who are committed about their faith, that two people who are well-read and have studied matters and have sought things out in prayer, where they could still arrive at different conclusions and still be faithful to Christ. And so the fact that people arrive at different conclusions isn't so much the problem here in regards to these secondary matters, but it's the fact that when people arrived at different conclusions, they turned around and condemned other people for not agreeing with them. And as we look just at these first five verses, we see that this primarily had to do with matters of diet, with things that people either were choosing to eat or choosing to not eat. And while we don't know this at this point yet in Romans chapter 14, this will become a bit more clear in our passage next week as we look at in the second half of this chapter. But what's almost certainly going on here is that Paul is writing to the Jewish and Gentile believers of Rome, and they are having this disagreement because there are members of the Jewish community that are still continuing to adhere to Jewish dietary customs, to Jewish dietary laws. And while that's a little bit unclear because he's talking about people who eat meat and don't eat meat, and Jewish people could still eat meat, there was a way that they could eat meat, and there were certain kinds of meat that they could eat, and maybe that was less available. And so, as Paul's writing to them, he's saying that there are some people that will eat certain things and some people that will not eat them, and that they're judging one another for the decisions that are being made. And it becomes even more clear that this is likely a Jewish and Gentile disagreement as we read on, beginning in verse 5, where it says, "One person esteems one day as better than another, while another esteems all days alike. Each one should be fully convinced in his own mind. The one who observes the day honors it, observes it in honor of the Lord. The one who eats, eats in honor of the Lord, since he gives thanks to God. While the one who abstains, abstains in honor of the Lord and gives thanks to God." So this addresses significant days as well. There were certain days on the calendar that some people thought needed to be remembered or celebrated, or that certain customs and traditions needed to happen on those days. And there were other people in that Roman church who didn't think those days needed to be held in great importance, that thought that all days had the same amount of importance. And again, this is almost certainly a reference back to the Jewish feast days or holidays that were prescribed in the Old Testament law. So there were things that had been required of the Jewish people, and now there were these Gentiles that came in to the church, and they had not previously lived under those laws, and they were not seeing the importance of following those traditions while other people were. And essentially, what Paul says here is that this problem exists not where people have opinions, but that when people have opinions in these matters of secondary importance, that they are turning around and arguing over them, or are so convinced that other people need to be on their side of the argument, that they begin to condemn, that they begin to judge, that they begin to make accusations that other people are living in sin or are living incorrectly because of the convictions that they hold. And so they're talking about important things that are at stake here, and important ways in which the unity and the cohesiveness of the early church is at stake here. And there are just a few important things that I want to highlight about this passage. The first is that Paul's reference here is that the Jews are the ones that he refers to as being weaker in the faith, or being people that have weak faith in this kind of scenario. And that's an interesting thing, because the Jewish Christians living in Rome certainly would not have seen themselves as the weaker brother or the weaker sister, or the people that were weaker in their faith. You know, after all, in their minds, they were the ones that were adhering to more strict rules. They were the ones that were taking extra burdens upon themselves to follow the law that had been given. They were the ones that were observing these special dietary restrictions and restricting what they would eat, and were going out of their way to celebrate certain festivals and holidays and things of that nature. As a result, they almost certainly would have seen themselves not as the ones that were weaker in the faith, but as the ones that were stronger in the faith, the ones that were more serious about this idea of following Jesus, the ones that were more serious about living in a manner that was holy and pious. They already, even before a discussion of piety or following the law or customs would have come into play, they already would have seen themselves as the stronger ones, because they were from God's chosen people, because Jesus himself had come as a Jewish Messiah, because all of the early leaders in the Christian church were Jews that recognized Jesus as the Messiah. And so as a result, they would have understood themselves as the stronger brother and not the weaker brother. And this idea, even of using that term, that idea of being weaker in faith, is interesting. Because Paul isn't saying in any capacity that the Jewish people did not believe in Jesus as much as the Gentile Christians. That the Jewish Christians and the Gentile Christians, he wasn't saying that Jews believed in Jesus less than the Gentiles did that were in the church. He isn't saying in that the Jewish people were kind of unsure of who Jesus was, that they were weaker in faith in that kind of capacity. He isn't saying anything that they might have doubts about their faith, or they might be considering leaving the faith or anything like that when he talks about them being weaker in the faith. What he's saying is that in this instance, in this circumstance, the people that were adhering to this special restricted diet, and the people that were saying that they needed to celebrate these days, that they were the ones that were less mature in their faith. And the reason for that is because they were so concerned with following, and not just following, but enforcing these special observations, these special things, that they were missing the point in what Jesus had come to do in this kind of capacity. That what they were trying to do essentially, which is something that Christians try to do all of the time, you know, from even before Paul wrote this letter to the Roman church, all the way through history, even to the present day, is that they were trying to add more things in to what it meant to be a Christian. They were trying to say, yes, we believe in Jesus, but also we think that it's really important that you need to do X, Y, or Z, that you need to follow this dietary restriction, that you need to continue to celebrate this holiday or this feast day in the Jewish tradition. They were trying to take Jesus and to say you need to believe in Jesus, and also add a couple of things in there as matters of essential importance. And Paul says that even while they might be taking their faith more seriously, that at the end of the day, that legalism, that idea that what we do could somehow earn us righteousness, actually is an indicator that their faith was weaker than the people that, perhaps ironically, didn't feel that need or that pressure to try to earn their righteousness, because they were relying on Jesus alone. So what Paul does in part in this passage is really just to affirm the gospel. What Paul does in this passage, in Romans chapter 14, in these verses, is to affirm what he has taught in the first half of the Roman letter. He once again is addressing that we don't earn our righteousness on our own, that there's nothing that we could do, no practice we could observe, no dietary restriction that we could uphold, no holiday or feast day that we could celebrate or religious ceremony that we could do that would somehow cause us to be in a position of righteousness. And this is why Paul's response to those Romans is essentially to say that when they're bickering over things like that, they are missing the point. In verses 3 and 4, he makes it really clear that it isn't worth their time to dispute over these matters, because the thing that is of most importance, the thing that we need to recognize, is that we don't need to judge each other, that Christians didn't need to judge one another over these matters of secondary importance, because ultimately they weren't servants of one another, they were servants of and followers of God. He makes that really clear in verses 7 to 9 as he writes, "For none of us lives to himself, and none of us dies to himself. For if we live, we live to the Lord, and if we die, we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. For to this end, Christ died and lived again, that he might be Lord both of the dead and of the living." In verse 7, Paul makes it clear that we are not our own master or judge. We don't live and die unto ourselves. We aren't the people that control our own destiny. And really, we aren't the people that evaluate whether or not we have lived well at the end of our days. And he also makes it clear that we're not only not our own master or judge, but that we certainly are not anyone else's master or judge. We aren't the people that get to pick apart and to tell others how they are supposed to live, because Christ is Lord. And just to be really clear, this doesn't mean that Paul affirms every behavior or every line of thinking. If you read through his letter to Corinth, or even if you read through the earlier parts of the letter to the Roman church, as we've looked at, there are plenty of behaviors and issues that we see Paul has no problem identifying or addressing as being sinful behavior, or as thoughts that go contrary to the gospel and to the truth about Christ. If you read his teaching, it's clear that he thinks there are right things to do and wrong things to do. It's clear that he thinks there are right things that we need to believe, and that there are things that are incorrect that we need to not believe and not follow. However, Paul also understands that opinions exist. He understands that especially in regards to opinions or to disputable matters, matters of secondary importance, that they aren't worth arguing over or judging one another over, because ultimately Christ is Lord and not Paul, or not either of the sides of Christians living in Rome or the leaders of the Roman church. And this idea that we need to hold fast to what is essential, and then we need to not waste time arguing over matters that are non-essential or condemning one another over matters that are non-essential, is a message that we need to embrace as a church. You know, we live in a moment right now where there are a whole lot of disputable matters, where there are a whole lot of things that can divide the church in the season that we live in. There are a whole lot of things that people are saying that Christians need to be doing right now, and other things that people are saying Christians need to not be doing right now. And you know, I, in a lighthearted way, tried to address the mask issue that's going on in churches today. But the reality is that churches all across America and in other countries that are beginning to or planning for this process of reopening are finding that there are so many different opinions on what Christians need to do or not do as they begin to prepare to gather together again for worship. And this, of course, has always been the case. There have always been these kinds of disputable matters. Christians throughout time have been arguing over what style of music they prefer to have in their worship services. Christians throughout time have argued over what kind of preaching is appropriate to have in their worship services. There are opinions on what matters should be discussed in sermons and what matters shouldn't, on whether you should preach in a topical way or an exegetical way, on whether you should go for 30 minutes or 40 minutes, or you shouldn't go a second over 20 minutes. There are all kinds of different matters that we can discuss and dispute as a church. We can argue over different ways of communicating with one another. We can argue over different ways of celebrating the Lord's Supper. We can argue over different translations of Scripture. And we see arguments that take place or people that hold very strong opinions in regards to those things all of the time. And I'm not saying that what we think isn't important. I'm not saying, and I don't think Paul says anywhere, that these disputable matters are unimportant. However, even while we have the freedom, you know, he calls them disputable matters. He calls them opinions. And I think there's a freedom there to be able to discuss disputable matters, these matters of secondary importance. There's freedom there to dispute them, to have a passionate even disagreement with one another over these things that you hold to be important in the faith. But what Paul teaches against here is that Christians need to be really careful to not elevate disputable matters to issues of core importance, and then also certainly to not judge other believers over these disputable matters or over opinions. As Christ's church, we need to be a people that are focused on the things that are most important. There's a popular phrase that addresses this in church circles, and this is popular throughout a number of different denominations and Christian traditions. And while it's a phrase that can be difficult to take back to its original source, it's believed that this comes from a theologian by the name of Rupertus Meldinius, who was a 17th century German Lutheran. And he wrote, and he was a theologian, during the 30 Years' War in Europe. And if you know just a little bit about European history, the 30 Years' War was one of the most terrible conflicts or periods of conflict that took place in really all of Western history, and certainly that took place on European soil. It's one of the most kind of difficult periods of human history on European soil. And in the midst of that, this theologian, Meldinius, he wrote in a tract on Christian unity, this phrase, where he said, "In essentials unity, in non-essentials liberty, and in all things charity." And he wrote that in a season of conflict. You know, it wasn't just that there was this backdrop of war, and he was writing to people about this sentiment of unity and peace and charity among them. But the 30 Years' War was driven in no small part. One of the main reasons for that war was over religious groups that were fighting against one another, and both groups that were claiming to be under Christ. And so Meldinius wrote to people living in that era, and said how important it was that in essentials, people were unified. That there are these matters of core importance, these truths that we need to get right and to understand about who God is and about who we are as people and about what Jesus has done on our behalf. That there are matters of core importance, and that in those matters, we need to be unified. And then also, that there are these secondary issues that exist, and that we have liberty in those secondary issues to have our own opinions and preferences. That we have liberty in those secondary issues to be under Christ and to believe in Christ and to have an orthodox faith, and at the same time to find ourselves having differences of opinion with other believers. And then, and this is the thing that really is significant about what Meldinius wrote, was that in all things, we are to be a people that practice charity towards one another. That, you know, we can wrestle with those non-essentials with one another, but we need to do so with a spirit of charity towards other people. That we can even wrestle with those essential matters where we're seeking to get to a place of unity, but even in that we need to approach other people with a sense of charity, that in all things, in all areas where we might find ourselves in disagreement with others, we need to be a people that are charitable to one another. We see that as Paul closes this section in verses 10 to 12 by saying, "Why do you pass judgment on your brother? Or you, why do you despise your brother? For we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. For it is written, 'As I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess to God.' So then each of us will give an account of himself to God." Let's strive to live in such a manner that when we have that moment Paul talks about here, that when we have that moment when we stand before God, when we give an account, when our life is before him, that we would be a people that held to this phrase where in essentials we were unified, where non-essentials we had liberty, and in all things we practiced charity towards one another. Let's be those kinds of people that live in the way that Jesus taught us to treat other people, even other people that we disagree with. Let's be those kinds of people that are living out what Paul's writing about in this picture of the transformed life, where we love and care and live at peace with other people, where we are charitable towards other people. Imagine how different the religious climate in America might look if people followed this kind of teaching that Paul provides for us in Romans chapter 14, or if people adhered to that wisdom of Rupertus Maldinius in the way that they approached other people. Think about how we would live with one another if instead of questioning other people's motives or condemning other people for conclusions that they've arrived at, if we were the kind of church that acted in charity and love towards other people. Let's be that kind of a church. Let's recognize other people for who they are. People that are servants of God, like Paul writes about here. People that are made in the image of God. People that have been redeemed by Christ. Let's seek to love other Christians in this kind of a way, even in moments where we might be divided or find ourselves talking about disputable matters in so many different areas of life.